This is VOA News reporting by remote. I'm Michael Brown. The U.S. and South Korea are jointly warning North Korea that use of any kind of nuclear weapon against Seoul or other regional allies will result in the end of Kim Jong-un's regime. AP correspondent Ben Thomas reports.
Secretary Lloyd Austin met with his South Korean counterpart at the Pentagon after North Korea launched more than two dozen missiles in response to U.S.-South Korean military exercises. The purpose of those exercises, says Austin,
to strengthen our combined readiness and our ability to fight tonight if necessary.
Through a translator, South Korean Defense Minister Lee Jong-sup says the U.S. and South Korea are united and resolute in their stance toward North Korea.
Any nuclear attack by the DPRK, including the use of tactical nuclear weapons, is unacceptable and result in the end of Kim Jong-un regime by the overwhelming and decisive response of the alliance.
Ben Thomas, Washington.
U.S. Defense Secretary Lloyd Austin said Thursday that Ukrainian forces can retake the strategic southern city of Kherson from Russian troops and would be a major defeat for Russia. Austin's remarks coincided with a Russian installed official in Kherson region saying Moscow was likely to pull its troops from the west bank of the Dnipro River. If that statement is confirmed, it would signal a significant Russian retreat. Austin did not answer a question about whether Russian forces were preparing to leave, but he expressed confidence in their ability to beat back Russian forces. The region's capital and river port, Kherson, is the only big city Russia has captured intact since its invasion began on February the 24th. Via remote, this is VOA News. Ethiopia's military held a memorial service for soldiers killed in 2 years of war, the day after an agreement was signed calling for a permanent cessation of hostilities. The agreement obtained by the Associated Press calls for the disarmament of Tigray forces and federal control of the Tigray region and is designed to end a two-year war that is believed to have killed hundreds of thousands of people. The signed agreement, which hasn't been made public, spells out what the Tigray lead negotiator described at Wednesday's signing, that is, as painful concessions. Ethiopian Federal Security Forces will take full control of all federal facilities, installations, and major infrastructure such as airports and highways within the Tigray region. South African police are investigating the discovery of at least 21 bodies suspected of being illegal miners and found near an active mine just west of Johannesburg. Illegal mining gangs are considered dangerous by the police, usually armed and unknown to fight violent turf battles with rival groups. U.S. Embassy officials in Moscow have visited jailed WNBA star Brittany Griner just weeks after a Russian court rejected her appeal. AP correspondent Ben Thomas reports.
Brittany Griner is serving a 9-year sentence. She was convicted of drug possession after Russian police said they found cannabis oil in her luggage at Moscow's airport. White House Press Secretary Karine Jean-Pierre.
We are told she is doing as well as can be expected under the circumstances.
The State Department adds the officials saw firsthand her tenacity and perseverance, and the U.S. is pushing for her immediate release, as well as that of Paul Whelan. He was sentenced in 2020 to 16 years in prison on espionage-related charges he and his family say are bogus. Ben Thomas, Washington.
Former Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu on Thursday appeared set to return to power as head of Israel's most right-wing government ever after winning this week's national election, with the current caretaker prime minister conceding defeat. Final results showed Netanyahu's Likud party and its ultra-nationalists and religious partners capturing a solid majority in Israel's Knesset or parliament. Israel on Tuesday held its fifth election since 2019 in a race like the previous four that was widely seen as a referendum on Netanyahu's fitness to rule as he faces corruption charges. As always, for more news, we invite you to join us at our website, voanews.com, also on the VOA mobile app. I'm Michael Brown reporting by remote, VOA News.
Thank you. Today is Friday, November 4th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I am Chinedu Afo in Washington. Coming up in the next half hour, fears of an inter-Korean war grows as Pyongyang fires multiple rockets, including a possible failed intercontinental ballistic missile.
Now, the evacuation orders are not happening everywhere, only in certain regions whenever North Korea launches missiles. But it's getting a little bit harder for South Koreans to ignore. This also happened in Japan.
Europe's largest nuclear power plant in Ukraine runs on emergency power after systems collapsed.
They see signs that Russian forces would try to reconnect the Zaporizhzhia nuclear power plant to the power lines of Crimea and Donbas areas, which are currently occupied.
And former Pakistan Prime Minister survives an assassination attempt while leading a march on Islamabad. We'll have these stories and more next on International Edition. Stay tuned. Analysts fear that the Korean Peninsula could be on the brink of an all-out war as North Korea continues the barrage of missile launches. This as Pyongyang fired at least six missiles into the sea on Thursday, including an intercontinental ballistic missile that triggered evacuation warnings and halted trains in northern Japan. The ICBM tests were followed by launches of two short-range ballistic missiles in the morning, drawing swift condemnation by South Korea, the United States, and Japan. For more, I spoke with VOA Seoul Bureau Chief Bill Gallo.
North Korea has always launched a lot of missiles, so South Koreans usually don't get too excited over this. But I'll tell you what, it's sort of hard to ignore whenever your television is interrupted with air raid sirens or you get emergency evacuation orders. Now, the evacuation orders are not happening everywhere, only in certain regions whenever North Korea launches missiles. But it's getting a little bit harder for South Koreans to ignore. This also happened in Japan yesterday, where there were lots of residents who were told to evacuate indoors temporarily while authorities thought a missile flew over Japan. We don't know how bad this will get. It's clear we are in a cycle of provocations where both sides are sort of showing their displays of military strength. There is a real chance that this could escalate to the point of someone being killed. It has happened before. There's precedent for it. Around 2010, North Korea shelled a frontline island and several people died. This is not something that has not happened. It has periodically happened since the end of the Korean War. However, it's important to know that every time those hostilities have been contained, so there is no expectation that there will be any kind of widespread war breaking out.
And what about the reactions from Pyongyang's neighbors, Japan, South Korea? We understand on their reports that they are putting their forces on the alert in case if this escalates.
Yes, definitely. And militaries in this region, meaning the U.S. and its allies, South Korea and Japan, are definitely on alert. There's no question about that. And I think one of the big dangers here is miscalculation or some type of accident. You know, missiles don't always do what you think they'll do. We've had several missile failures by both South Korea and North Korea over the last year. And so there always is a danger during times like this that something goes wrong, or that maybe a hot-headed person decides to not respond in such a cool way according to plan. So yes, everyone is on alert here. It is quite tense in military settings, and there is a danger that things will go wrong, even though I must stress again that on the street, most people are not thinking about this, for instance, in South Korea.
That's VOA Seoul Bureau Chief Bill Gallo speaking with me from the South Korean capital. In response to North Korean missile launches in recent days, the United States and South Korea have decided to extend their current joint military exercise. This story from VOA's chief national correspondent Steve Herman in Washington.
U.S. Defense Secretary Lloyd Austin, after meeting with his South Korean counterpart at the Pentagon on Thursday, told reporters the Vigilant Storm aerial drill involving more than 240 American and South Korean aircraft is being extended amid the provocations from Pyongyang, and other joint exercises also to be held on the Korean Peninsula will be enhanced. Austin said the U.S. military's current posture, despite the recent barrage of North Korean test launches of missiles and artillery firing, is effective in preventing a war.
We are focused on making sure that nobody attacks South Korea, and we're committed to that. Our commitment is ironclad. And we're also committed to deterring anyone from using a nuclear device.
South Korean Defense Minister Lee Jong-suk, alongside Austin, said, despite the North Korean provocations, it is not necessary for the United States to redeploy nuclear weapons on the Korean Peninsula. Steve Herman, VOA News, Washington.
Europe's largest nuclear power plant is relying on emergency diesel generators to run its safety systems after external power from the Ukrainian electric grid was cut off. Fighting in Ukraine has repeatedly damaged power lines and substations that the Zaporizhzhia nuclear power plant requires to operate safety systems. That's forced operators to turn to backup generators to cool its six reactors. All six reactors have been shut down. Anna Chernikova in Kyiv updates Flashpoint Ukraine, Steve Miller.
We see signs that Russian forces would try to reconnect the Zaporizhzhia nuclear power plant to the power lines of Crimea and Donbas areas, which are currently occupied. And basically, they said that this was, apparently, it was the main goal for these damages.
In addition to the Zaporizhzhia region, there have been other attacks throughout Ukraine, especially there in the south. What can you share with us about what's going on today?
Well, we have some new confirmations from the general staff and from the Ministry of Defense of Ukraine. And basically, this past night was very tough in the Dnipropetrovsk region and also in the Zaporizhzhia region, as we already know, and Mykolaiv region. So we know that there were shelling of critical infrastructure, energy infrastructure, again, as a target. And there are heavy damages of some of the facilities, which have been already confirmed. So the repair works are ongoing for the moment. And this happened in different cities of the region. Also, the city of Mykolaiv is under very heavy shelling for the past weeks in general. And again, shelling is happening there as well. What is also important, we talk about south, it's there are confirmations from Ukrainian officials and reports from Ukrainian officials that actually there are a lot of explosions happening now on the Okhchyt territory. So we're talking about the city of Melitopol, and we are also talking about the city of Kherson and Kherson region, which is currently under Russian control. So this is confirmed information, again, from the Ukrainian side. We cannot verify it independently, but still this goes in line with the counteroffensive, which continues in that area. Also, the Ministry of Defense of Ukraine confirmed yesterday late evening that one of the most difficult parts of the front line for the moment, where the most heavy fightings are happening, is actually Donetsk region, and especially we're talking about Bakhmut, Solidar.
That's reporter Anna Chernikova in Kyiv speaking with Flashpoint Ukraine, Steve Miller. Australian Foreign Affairs Minister Penny Wong has signed an agreement in Thailand to support a new training centre aimed at fighting human trafficking. Phil Mercer reports from Sydney.
The training centre will give more help to victims of trafficking and will also make them not liable for any crimes committed during time as forced or coerced labourers. The move is part of an effort between Canberra and the Association of Southeast Asian Nations, the ASEAN-Australia Counter-Trafficking Initiative. The 10-year program announced in 2019 is aimed at rescuing victims and ensuring perpetrators are held to account. The agreement with Thailand was signed Wednesday by Australian Foreign Affairs Minister Penny Wong. Human Rights Watch Asia Director Elaine Pearson told local media that despite Thailand's commitments, it still has a significant human trafficking problem, particularly with migrants exploited from neighbouring Myanmar, Cambodia and Laos. Almost 300 cases of modern-day slavery and human trafficking were reported to Australian Federal Police in the past year. However, Jennifer Byrne, the director of Anti-Slavery Australia, an advocacy organisation, said the true scale of the trade in men, women and children is hard to gauge. She told the Australian Broadcasting Corporation Thursday of the case of a woman who was enslaved with a family in the city of Melbourne.
She was tricked into coming to Australia. She held a tourist visa, held in a condition of slavery for 9 years in a Melbourne suburb. She was forced to cook, clean and care for children. She was on call 24/7. Eventually, she became so ill. She was taken to hospital in a medical emergency, and the couple there were found guilty of possessing a slave.
Byrne said the perpetrators in the case were jailed. Modern slavery is a global issue. 50 million people were living in modern slavery in 2021, according to the latest global estimates of modern slavery, a survey by the International Labour Organization, human rights group Walk Free, and the International Organization for Migration. According to data released in September, when the report was released, 28 million people were in forced labour and 22 million were trapped in forced marriage. Australia has also signed an agreement with Thailand for a four-year plan on military and economic cooperation as Canberra seeks deeper engagement with Southeast Asia. Phil Mercer for VOA News, Sydney.
Thank you, Phil. And as nations prepare to attend a major climate change conference in Egypt next week, the World Health Organization warns climate-related health emergencies are surging and threatening the lives of millions of people in the Greater Horn of Africa. Lisa Schlein reports for VOA from Geneva.
The United Nations reports up to 222 million people globally are facing acute hunger, 47 million of them in the Greater Horn of Africa. Most parts of the region are battling the worst drought in 40 years. After four consecutive years of drought and a fifth season of failed rains looming, health experts fear great loss of life. A new WHO analysis of seven countries in the region finds disease outbreaks and climate-related emergencies have reached their highest ever level this century. Analysts have recorded a total of 39 health emergencies this year in Djibouti, Ethiopia, Kenya, Somalia, South Sudan, Sudan, and Uganda. Egmont Evers is WHO's incident manager for Greater Horn of Africa Food Insecurity and Health. He says the food insecurity crisis in the region also is a health crisis. He says these twin disasters are interrelated.
Malnourished people become sick more easily, and sick people become malnourished more easily. The outcomes when disease and malnutrition are combined are worse. We know this about the combination of cholera and malnutrition, measles and malnutrition, common childhood diseases and malnutrition. There is more severe disease and more death. We know globally already that 45% of all child deaths are linked to malnutrition.
Evers says lack of food also leads to increased displacement. People who suffer from food insecurity, he says, leave their homes in search of something to eat. He notes this makes the region's more than 18 million refugees and internally displaced people particularly vulnerable to illness and death.
Displacement means interruption of life-saving health care, such as immunization, maternal and child care, but also increased risks, such as poor water and sanitation, overcrowding, malnutrition, risky coping behaviors, and loss of livelihoods. We're seeing that these public health events are becoming more common, and the combination with increasing food insecurity and malnutrition means that they will also be more deadly.
Drought is not the only extreme weather event in the region. Sudan and South Sudan have been hit with widespread torrential rains in recent weeks. The World Health Organization says South Sudan is experiencing its fourth consecutive year of flooding and estimates that 40% of the country is underwater. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
In other news, Pakistani officials say former Prime Minister Imran Khan was slightly wounded in the leg by a gunman who opened fire at his protest convoy. The shooting killed one of Khan's supporters and wounded nine other people in the Waziribad district of Punjab province of eastern Pakistan. Khan was traveling in a large convoy of vehicles heading to the capital of Islamabad as part of his campaign to force early elections. You're listening to VOA's International Edition. I'm Chinedofo in Washington. Arab leaders on Wednesday concluded the 31st summit in the capital, Algiers. Arab leaders acknowledged the dire consequences of the war in Ukraine for their nations and called for a, quote, collective Arab action, unquote, to face common challenges. Those include food and security shortages and the effects of climate change on their societies, but they presented no details on the potential mechanism that would help feed their people. William Lawrence, professor of international relations at American University in Washington, gave his assessment of the summit to VOA senior analyst Mohamed El-Shenawy.
Well, it was good that the meeting happened. It was good that it focused on Palestine, an issue that isn't covered enough regionally. And it was good that the UN Secretary General was there and there were other international participations. They didn't have it for 3 years, so it's good that the Arab League is back together. You know, and if you look at the history of the Arab League, you know, other than promoting the Palestinian issue, summits don't usually accomplish that much. And the main goal here is that the poorer Arab League members would like that the richer members underwrite their weathering of the storms related to the issues that you mentioned, the food crisis, the energy crisis, climate change crisis. But within the Arab League, the amount of difference of opinion is greater than ever, probably. There's a lack of consensus over Ukraine, over Palestine, over Syria, over Iran, Turkey, even over Western Sahara. There is some growing agreement over the Libya issue and the Yemen issue, but generally there isn't a lot of unity here, even though that was the theme of the conference. It also bears repeating that the countries in the Arab League have helped given Russia varying degrees of geopolitical and diplomatic cover for its illegal invasion of Ukraine, which violates Algeria and the Arab League's strong positions on sovereignty and territorial integrity. So they do need, as a group, to fix the downsides of working with Putin, who did address the conference and asked for greater engagement of the Arab countries with Russia. But they've been engaged in a greater way than ever, but they're sort of lying to themselves that there is a neutral position to take when one people is invading and murdering another people and committing a form of genocide. So they need the mechanisms to implement the goals that they express that you listed, but they also need to start by rethinking their position towards Russia and therefore with the world, and to accelerate positive actions vis-a-vis climate change by thinking about their own role in creating these problems rather than just being victims of these problems.
That's William Lawrence, Professor of International Relations at American University in Washington, speaking with my colleague Mohamed El-Shenawy. Israel's longest-serving Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu is set to return to power a year after being ousted. With nearly all votes counted, Netanyahu's Likud party emerges as the single largest party and is now able to put together a governing coalition with ultra-Orthodox and right-wing parties. Linda Granstein reports for VOA from Jerusalem.
Benjamin Netanyahu and his Likud party are clearly the big winners of Tuesday's election, Israel's fourth in 5 years. The former leader looks on track to put together a right-wing religious coalition with ultra-Orthodox and far-right extremist parties. "Today we have won a huge vote of confidence," Netanyahu told supporters. The other big winner is right-wing extremist Itamar Ben-Gvir, whose religious Zionism party is now Israel's third largest. He has already said he wants to become Israel's Minister of Internal Security, responsible for such sensitive issues as the relations between Jews and Muslims at Jerusalem's holy sites. After the election, Ben-Gvir said that everyone is asking for real change. People want to walk safely down the street. They want the hands of our soldiers and policemen not to be bound. And they want to make a clear distinction between those who are loyal to the State of Israel, whom we have no problem with, and those who act to undermine the existence of our dear country. The new government's first priority will be putting an end to Netanyahu's ongoing corruption trial, according to some Israeli analysts. Jonathan Reinhold is a professor of political science at Bar-Ilan University.
Netanyahu will want to pass a law which has been suggested by religious Zionism, which will in effect end his trial.
Analysts including Gail Telshir also say that Netanyahu will change Israel's foreign policy priorities.
Netanyahu praises himself for changing the way of looking at the Middle East, putting away the Palestinian-Israeli conflict and talking about Iran and not about the Palestinians. So first of all, I think we're going to go back into the no negotiation kind of ideas that came from Netanyahu before him.
The elections come as tensions between Israelis and Palestinians have increased. Palestinian officials, such as Palestinian Prime Minister Mohammed Shteya, say Netanyahu's victory is bad news for them. He said that we are aware that these elections will not lead to a partnership for peace. Israeli analysts say the election results bringing far-right parties into the government could also cause tensions with the Biden administration, which has called on Israel to restart talks with the Palestinians. Linda Gradstein for VOA News, Jerusalem.
Hi, I'm Kim Lewis. Join me and our panel of journalists as we discuss the top stories of the week, including political candidates who are making their final pitches for the highly anticipated midterm elections on November 8th. Results will set the balance of power in Congress and state capitals around the country. We'll examine this and more on Issues in the News this Saturday and Sunday on The Voice of America.
Hello, I'm Carol Castiel. Changing of the guard in Latin America's largest country. Leftist candidate and former president Luiz Inácio Lula da Silva narrowly defeated right-wing populist incumbent Jair Bolsonaro in one of Brazil's most hotly contested elections. How will former President Lula unite the highly polarized electorate? Two Latin American experts discuss the ramifications of Lula's victory in Brazil. Next on Encounter on The Voice of America.
Go beyond the daily headlines with VOA's Flashpoint Ukraine. Each weekday, join us as we put the latest developments into a global context with stories, interviews, and analysis. Listen online at voanews.com/flashpoint or in your favorite podcast player.
This has been International Edition on The Voice of America. On behalf of the entire production team, thank you so much for listening. Visit our website for in-depth coverage of world events and news 24 hours at voanews.com and check out voaafrica.com for more English language programming. You can find International Edition and our current affairs programs, Encounter, Press Conference USA, and Issues in the News on voanews.com. Until next time, I am Chinedu in Washington. Have a wonderful weekend.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
Deadly Russian airstrikes using Iranian-made kamikaze drones are rocking cities in Ukraine, killing civilians and damaging residential buildings, power stations, sewage treatment plants, bridges, and playgrounds. State Department Deputy Spokesperson Vedant Patel warned that Russia's deepening alliance with Iran is something the entire world, especially those in the region, should view as a profound threat. In response, the United States, the United Kingdom, and France raised the issue of Iran's transfer of unmanned aerial vehicles, or UAVs, at a meeting of the UN Security Council. The United States expressed its grave concerns about Russia's acquisition of these UAVs from Iran in violation of the UN Security Council Resolution 2231, said State Department spokesperson Ned Price in a statement. The United States began warning in July that Iran was planning to transfer UAVs to Russia for use in Russia's brutal war against Ukraine, said spokesperson Price. And we now have abundant evidence that these UAVs are being used to strike Ukrainian civilians and critical civilian infrastructure. Iran has denied supplying weapons to Russia despite abundant evidence to the contrary. U.S. Mission to the United Nations spokesperson Nate Evans confirmed that there is ample evidence that Russia is using Iranian-made UAVs in cruel and deliberate attacks against the people of Ukraine, including against civilians and critical civilian infrastructure. By procuring these weapons in violation of UN Security Council resolutions, Russia continues to flout international law in its pursuit of a senseless and brutal war against Ukraine, he declared. As Iran continues to lie about providing weapons to Russia for use in Ukraine, the United States is committed to working with allies and partners to prevent the transfer of dangerous weaponry to Russia, said spokesperson Price. We will not hesitate to use our sanctions and other appropriate tools on all involved in these transfers. We will also continue to surge unprecedented security assistance to Ukraine, including air defense capabilities, so that Ukraine can defend itself from these weapons.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.